Okay, new topic, living out loud as a Christian. I'm going to be mostly talking about my mentor and my hero, Walter Bradley, but we'll talk about some other things also. It starts out, where do you think I got this graphic from? You got it, ChatGPT, that's right. I asked for three heroes, a sportsman, a movie star, and a superhero. And this is the image that it gave me. So I thought, wow, that's pretty good. And this is usually who we have as heroes today, our sports stars, movie stars, and I don't know, fictional superheroes. We very rarely have as heroes people who have made a substantive contribution to society. Great mothers, great evangelists, great teachers, great people of faith. And so I'm gonna talk about that a little bit. And also living out loud as a Christian. When I was a professor at the University of Washington, I was a closet Christian. I didn't profess my Christianity. I never denied it, but I never lived out loud as a Christian. Because you know why? I was afraid somebody might hurt my feelings because they would push back on my faith. And that's really a stupid reason to do that. And the importance of that is really dictated by John Lennox. John Lennox was asked, what do you think the first thing's gonna happen when you go to heaven? What do you think your impression's going to be? He said, kind of like these near-death experience people, he says, I'm going to look around and I'm going to think, oh my gosh, why didn't I tell more people about this? What a great response. That was what he thinks he's going to do in heaven. So I wanted to share a story. It was a personal blessing to me. I was writing my book, Noncomputable You, and I needed a picture of somebody who I hadn't met in 20 years, a guy named Pat Kelly. When I used to, before my PhD, I worked at Crane Naval Weapons Depot. I had these friends that were guitarists. Yes, I wanted to be a rock star. I think everybody that in my generation wants to be a rock star, right? So we all got together and wrote songs and played them and recorded them and had a really, really great time doing it. And one of them was my friend Pat Kelly. They would come over and they would spend their time, their weekends with me at my apartment before I got married, and we would just have a grand old time. I wanted to use one of Pat's pictures in my book, Noncomputable You. So I thought, you know, I need Pat's permission. And so I scoured Facebook and finally found him. Now when Pat came over, we did talk about God. Because when you become close to somebody, you talk about your faith. You can't keep from it. And so I did talk about God. I talked about Christ. I talked about my salvation experience as a junior in college. And I finally got a hold of him. I connected up on Facebook. And you want to see the picture that I used of him in my Noncomputable You? It was this. Okay. And it's in there, and it was on the chapter of Can AI Create Music? And I was trying to make the point the presentation of the music many times has as much to do with the type of presentation as it does with the actual music. And I wanted to use Pat's, he was an incredible guitarist, a wonderful, wonderful guy. So after 40 years of not meeting with him, I hooked up with him on Facebook. And I suspect that many of you, when you get to heaven, are going to have people that come up and talk to you, I hope this is the case, and said that, you know, you helped me find God, and I am here because of what you told me. And that was the case with Pat Kelly, and this is one of the greatest blessings of my life. I got a hold of him on Facebook, and he wrote me back, and he said, you groomed me. You are forever in my heart. So far, I have a granddaughter doing missionary work. He wasn't a Christian when I talked to him, but we talked about Christ. And he says, last year to grandkids saved and baptized, you're a hero to me, sir, and I cherish it. Wow! What an experience to a guy after 40 years and you hadn't met him and you didn't know the influence that you had on his life. And then he said something incredibly interesting. When he came over and we talked about God, I said, you know, you need to have a Bible. So I gave him a Bible and he gave me a picture of it. This was 1975, so this is 25, 35, 45, 48 years ago. I gave him this Bible. And it was a living Bible, which was popular back then. And then I said to Brother Pat, from yours to Bob Marks, January 3rd, 1975. And then he wrote, I'm choking up here, he wrote me back and he said, Wow, what a moment. Son Mike, who has gotten back into the Word and needs a Bible he can understand. My heirloom has now been handed down to my only son, which was given to me by you. I have no words. I love you, Bob, with all my heart. I mean, think of the blessing that that gives. I mean, there's no greater blessing than being a part of being used by God to lead somebody to Christ. There's just no greater blessing. Now, with that, I wish I could always say that I lived out loud as a Christian. I didn't. For 17 years, I was advisor for Campus Crusade for Christ, and I went to all their weekend gatherings. And usually it was preaching, it was worship, it was just a good time. And I was invited by my good friend Brian Rickey. This is Brian here on the left. We're still good friends, and this was taken just about a month ago in Baltimore when I talked at Bridges International. And we got together and went to Nevada, and I thought it was going to be another, you know, weekend of teaching and stuff like that. And they said, no, we're going to go out and we're going to share Christ coldly to people on the streets of Nevada. Oh. And then this little girl came up, and you know, that was with Cam, said, we're going to tell people about Jesus. And here I was just scared to death. And so I told Brian, I lied to him. I said, Brian, you know, I'm really important. I'm a professor and I need to go to my room. I have some work I need to do tonight. I can't go out on the streets with you. And so I went up in my room and I prayed and I thought, you know, if I'm going to remain the advisor to Campus Crusade for Christ, I got to go out and do this. So I took a deep breath and I went to Brian, who was my confidant. It's wonderful to have a good friend that you could be a confidant in, that you can talk about your failings and your shortcomings and do a bilateral thing and then pray for each other. It's just an astonishing relationship. And that's the relationship that I've had about Brian. So I'm the kind of guy, if I walk down the street and I see a street preacher, I will move to the other side of the street, right? Because I'm afraid if I pass by him, he'll say, brother, do you believe in Jesus? And I would say, yes. And he said, preach it. And he would hand me the microphone, and it would just scare me to death. So this is the way I was. Guess where I got this picture? Yeah, ChatGPT. I did this also. Anyway, we went out and we did this. And I tell you, I had such an exhilaration of facing my fears. I have never bungee jumped, but I imagine it's like bungee jumping. You stand on the edge of the cliff, you're scared to death, and you take that little step of faith, you take that little step, and you go down and you begin bouncing. And there's such an exhilaration that happens when you do that and face your fears. And that's the exhilaration that I found when I finally went out, because Brian said, Bob, I know you're scared. Let you and me go out together. So we went out and teamed it together. And it worked out just wonderfully. Now, this was also true of my hero, Walter Bradley. Walter Bradley, still alive, still kicking, is a guy that I co-wrote a biography about. Dick was supposed to have it here. It hasn't come in, I guess, as of yet. But it's a man who, as a full-time professor, had a greater impact on Christianity and academia than probably anybody in the 20th century. It's just astonishing. We're going to go through a few of these things. And he and Brian helped me to live out loud as a Christian. One of the things that Walter did is when he went through and he got his PhD at University of Texas, he said he never once had a professor come out and admit that they were Christians. And this bugged him. And he said he was going to decide to tell his class that he was a Christian. Not preach to them, not do any Bible thumping, not to do any preaching, but just to say, I want you to know that I'm a Christian. And it means more than just going to church. It's the foundation of everything I do and everything I am, and that I hope this semester, as we talk together, that you're going to notice a difference. Now, that was putting himself up for a pretty big challenge, wasn't it? So Walter, he was married at the time to Anne, a wonderful, wonderful woman, and Walter decided that he tried it for 22 times. He prayed with his wife. He says, yeah, I'm going to go in and I'm going to tell my class that I'm a Christian. And he went in and he chickened out. Then they prayed again and he went in and they prayed and he chickened out. And he did this for 22 times in a row until he finally worked up the courage to do that. He was afraid to share his faith to his class, just like I was afraid to go out and share, you know, my faith on the street in Las Vegas, Nevada. So finally, on the last day, he rationalized, this is the last day. I'll probably never see these kids again, because he was a teaching assistant. And he says, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go in and I'm going to share my faith. So he went in and shared his faith. And then in a couple of days, he got a call from the dean. And the dean called and he said, are you Walter Bradley, teaching in mechanical engineering as a teaching assistant? He says, yes, I am. He says, you know, I've been going through the phone book with all the Bradleys, and I finally got you. Walter swallowed and said, yes. The dean said, I want to thank you. He said, I have twins in your class, and we have been trying to get them to go back to church, and they have just resisted. But after they heard your testimony in class, that was just astonishing. And I just want to thank you for having the guts to share your faith. So it was totally contrary to what Walter thought. So let me tell you a little bit about Walter. He was raised in Corpus Christi, lower middle class. He went to school, and he, as a white person, was the minority there. So he's been around a lot of people for a long time in terms of diversity. Here he is. I want to see if anybody of you know what is happening here. Nobody from university. Bevo, yeah, Bevo. Okay, this is the Texas A&M mascot. It's Bevo the cow or the bull or something like that, right? And there's a special honorary society called the Silver Spurs, and their job is to keep track of and take care of Bevo, take him to all the football games and do things like that. And Walter is right down here. Can you see my cursor? I guess you can't. He's down in the bottom right corner holding the steer. And so he had the academics enough to do this. Now, being brought up in the lower middle class was really rough. He was off at summer camp one time when he got a call and he said, Walter, we need you to come home. And this was when he was a teenager, much before this picture was taken. And they said, Walter, we need you to come home. And he came home and he found out that his father had shot and killed his brother and then committed suicide. It was a murder, it was a murder-suicide result. Walter was astonished because his father had taught him about God and everything, and Jesus, what happened? Later he found out that bipolar disorder ran in the family, and he says this was probably just a severe case of bipolar disorder. But imagine if you came home and you found out that your father, as a teenager, your father had shot your brother and then committed suicide. That you have, what Walter shared with me, he said, this is some of the deepest that I've ever had to dig in terms of my spiritual faith to get over. That would be just a tremendous, this is PSD stuff. But nevertheless, Walter grew up and he began to share his faith and became a worldwide evangelist for Christianity in academia, one of the hardest audiences there is. In his biography, we ask for a number of accolades for Walter, for people who had interacted with him. John Burke, he was a guy that wrote Imagine Heaven that we talked about last time. Now, Walter turned out to be going to John Burke's church. John Burke approached Walter, said, I've written this book, Imagine Heaven. Could you check the science in it? And Walter says, sure. And he checked the science. And if you look at the written portion of the book, you'll find Walter is mentioned as a helper in writing Imagine Heaven. William Lane Craig, and we saw William Lane Craig in the second lecture that I had. He was the one talking to Peter Atkins. He said, Walter Bradley is one of the most extraordinary men I have ever known. I am in awe of him. Well, I am in awe of William Lane Craig. He has such an intellect, it's just astonishing. You saw him in action with Peter Atkins. Robert Sloan, the former president of Baylor University and the current president of Houston Baptist University, said Walter Bradley is one of the most remarkable Christian scholars I've ever known. And this is where I got the title of this. Dr. Lawrence Murphy Smith, he's a CPA, he said, I learned from Walter that you can live out loud as a Christian in academia. So it always wasn't smooth sailing for Walter. One of the things that happened is that he shared his faith. He was a professor at Texas A&M at the time in the Department of Mechanical Engineering. He subsequently became the head of the Department of Mechanical Engineering, and he shared his faith, and he got a call from the dean. Now, I've related this story before, but it's worth repeating. Then Dean called him in the office and he said, you got to quit talking about Christianity and Christ in your classroom. That's no place that this should happen. Walter says, look, I'm not proselytizing. I'm not Bible thumping. I'm just telling the people who I am. And the dean said, nah, you know, separation of church and state or something like that. And then Walter says, okay, I get it. I understand. So if I do that, we're going to have to shut down all of the people that talk negatively about God, including the Peter Atkins types, including the Richard Dawkins type. We have to shut them down too. How are you going to do that? We need to be fair across the board. If I can't talk about Christ and be positive about Christ, they can't talk negatively about Christ. And the dean finally just shook his head and said, forget it. Go ahead and do what you want. Because he had no answer for that. He didn't know how to respond to that. And then Walter was being deposed for, this is very interesting, for the Texas textbook challenge. And I think I've shared this too. But it's worth repeating. He was under oath. He was in a deposition. They had a little court reporter there. And the head of the ACLU, came up and snidely said, Walter Bradley, if you've ever been deposed, you know that the opposing counsel always starts out with Dr. Bradley, because this doesn't come out in the transcripts. The transcripts just say Dr. Bradley. So the snideness doesn't come out. And he says, you're a Christian, right? And Walter said, yeah. And then he says, well, if you're a Christian, how can we believe anything that you say about science with your presupposed bias? Okay, this is the result that the secular side has. Walter says, excuse me, sir, I'm not the one with the problem. You live inside a little silo of materialism and naturalism. Everything that you think about must fit within this silo. I do not limit myself to the silo. I do believe in God, and when I look at something, I don't ask how or whether or not God did it. I ask how he did it, and I want you to know that I am outside the silo. So anybody that is narrow-minded, that won't look at the entire truth, you can't point your finger at me. It's you, because you are restricting yourself to this little silo, this little area of materialism. And so the lawyer changed the subject. So I thought that was a beautiful, beautiful retort. And I think as Christians, we have to remember that. We don't have to be defensive. We're much more broad-minded than the naturalists are, because we can believe in things which have the flavor of naturalism, but we can go beyond that. We're not constrained to okay, we'll forget this. Okay, finally the audio works. One of the things that Walter did at Texas A&M is he started a newspaper he organized the Christian faculty. And he got all the faculty at Texas A&M together in an organization, and they started printing things in the newspaper, in the, what would they call it, the A&M battalion, because A&M is very, very big in military, ROTC sort of things. And this is an example of one of the ads that they run. Seriously, this was an Easter. This guy rose from the dead 2,000 years ago, and now everyone celebrates with bunnies, eggs, and candies. No one can actually believe that anymore. And then he went on to explain the true meaning of Easter. And then below this, I didn't have room for it, was listed 30 or 40 Texas A&M faculty who these people could contact if they wanted to learn more about Jesus. Really, really exciting stuff. He did this for Easter too. I'm sorry, for Christmas. Leaves heaven for you. So he talks about the true meaning of Christian, that it's more than, you know, just presence. It's about the birth of Christ. So one of the things that happens is that Walter went to the Campus Crusade for Christ, and he said with a guy named Ray Mellencamp, he said, you need a ministry which ministers to faculty, because Campus Crusade, as it's known today, CRU, ministers mostly to students. He said, you need a ministry to faculty. So they founded something called Christian Faculty Fellowship, which now has become Faculty Commons, which is a ministry to faculty at universities who are followers of Christ. So a lot of us follow what Walter did. There's faculty commons groups all over the United States in most universities, and these are people with Campus Crusade staff full-time on them whose job is to minister to faculty. And Walter was the genesis of that. So we did something similar at Baylor. We ran an article in the Baylor Lariat about who Christianity is. Now, Baylor University, you're supposed to be a Christian if you're a faculty member. In fact, new hires have to interview the provost or an assignee of the provost to show that they are indeed Christian. But that doesn't always work out. So we had a number of people who I would say are evangelical Christians who signed on to this. We didn't have room, couldn't afford to list all their names in the paper, so we gave a website that they could go to, and they could contact these people if they wanted to talk more about Jesus. So that's one of the things that Walter did, okay? He began witnessing in the classroom of his Christian identity. He shared that with other people. I do it today. On the first day of class, I say what Walter says about identifying as a Christian. At Baylor, we can still pray, so I have a prayer the first day of class, and Walter was the one that taught us how to do that, how to live out loud as a Christian. Walter was also a big... one of the founders of, I will say, of creationism, if you will, and he wrote a book in 1986 called The Mystery of Life's Origin. Now, this has nothing to do with evolution. It identifies and explores where the first life came from. Where did the first life come from? And people, yeah, they don't know. He worked with a chemist and a person that was very knowledgeable in geology. And they went through all of the different requirements that it would take for the first life to occur. And I will say, even today, nobody knows where the first life came from. Nobody knows where the first life came from. So their book was totally scientific, and one of the things they wanted to do is go to a scientific publisher. So they went to a scientific publisher to not give their book a kind of a Christian flavor, but they wanted to address the entire general field. And only in the last chapter did they touch on Christianity, because they talked about the possible ways that first life would have been created on Earth. And he went through some of these different things, panspermia. And then he did mention that there was this idea about the biblical idea that God created this life, and that the reason that life was here was because of God's creation. And so the book had an incredible influence. It was actually endorsed by a number of people, including the head of the Jet Propulsion Lab. He said, this is really, really good stuff. And it made an incredible impact. So I'm the director of something called the Bradley Center, Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence, and now I think you can see why we named this center after him. And we decided to re-release Walter's book. This was a couple of years ago. So we invited a number of other people to come in and to contribute chapters, kind of updating what had happened since 1986 to what Walter and his co-authors did. And this is the reunion of the co-authors. A couple of years ago. Walter is in the middle with his wife, Anne. Thaxton is on the left, and Olson is on the right with their wives. And these people that wrote the chapter says, you know, this scientific analysis is pretty cool. They still don't know where the first life came from. There is no clue. The first life, even the most elementary life, is so complicated that there's no way that it could have ever happened by chance. So this wasn't all that Walter did. Another thing he did is he went to every university in North America, every major university, well, I should say almost, because it depends how you define almost every university. But he gave lectures, and the lectures were very controversial. And this is how I first met Walter. He came to the University of Washington and gave a talk on, is there scientific evidence for an intelligent creator of the universe? This was also called Scientific Evidence for the Existence of God. And he made this talk in front of all sorts of different crowds, and many times they were hostile. But Walter was just a very, very mild man, And he told me, he said, they come and they ask me these hostile questions. He said, after about four or five presentations, I knew the questions they were going to ask because they were always the same questions. And he said, I always had an answer. But he also said something interesting. He said, the way that I responded to the vile questions was just as important as the content of my talk. I could not get into an argument with them. I could not reduce myself to their level of having a back and forth argument. So he addressed all of the questions in a mild, reasoned fashion, and he won great people. So in the top here, you can see him teaching at Yale University, and the bottom at Cornell University. And at the bottom, you can see typically what happened at the end of his talk. A number of students gathered around asking more and more questions about God and the creation of life. So here he is on the upper left. This was at St. Petersburg, and this was only faculty and graduate students that were allowed to come here. And even then, you can see over on the left, there was standing room only for his presentation on the scientific evidence of God. On the right, you see him talking at the, Mexico. And on the bottom, this was at Jinghu University in China, and where he talked about the same challenge. This was 1 year before Tiananmen Square, so that China was still a little bit more open then, before it was Tiananmen Square. He went to Korea a lot and talked there a lot. Here he is on the cover of Worldview magazine. Worldview is a Christian magazine that is distributed in Korea, and he did a lot of work there. As I mentioned, he founded Faculty Commons. And this is the current website of Faculty Commons. If you go to Faculty Commons, I forget if it's .org or .com, you'll find out the ministry the Campus Crusade has towards faculty members, and this was due to the genesis of Walter Bradley. So you can see he had a very full life, but that's not all. He also started something called Appropriate Technology. Now, what is appropriate technology? He's a mechanical engineer, and appropriate technology is technology that you take to third world countries who don't need a supercomputer. They need some technology which is appropriate for their poor country. And so he did a lot of interesting things in appropriate technology. This still lives on at Baylor as Engineers with a Mission, and this is an organization which goes out and goes to countries and kind of helps them with their technology. On the left here, for example, you can see John Pumua. He's from Papua New Guinea. Very interesting story about Pumua. He visited Baylor. We had him and his family out to our place, and we used to have a place by the river, and we were eating outside, and there were a few mosquitoes, and we were out there doing this and slapping ourselves, and Pumua says, yes, he says, in Papua New Guinea, everybody has malaria. Slapping a mosquito. And he says, yes, I have malaria. My wife has malaria. His daughter was with him. He says, my daughter has malaria. We all have malaria. And so we quickly moved inside because that's the way, that's the way malaria is transmitted, is through mosquitoes. So that was a little spooky, but he was totally, totally clueless. But one of the things Papua New Guinea has is a lot of coconuts. So Walter figured, you know, is there something we could use coconuts for in order to start a business for the people in Papua New Guinea? And it turns out a lot of the coconuts go to waste. A lot of times they take the pulp out of them and they leave the coconut shells outside. And these coconut shells, they gather water. And guess what happens when coconut shells gather water? You get a great breeding place for mosquitoes, just like a big pile of old tires. They accumulate water, and it's a good place for mosquitoes. So he figured out a way to use the pulp for biodiesel fuel, and this is him on the left doing that with John Pumua. And on the right, you see he went down to Kenya, and he built a bridge across the river that helped people not have a 12-mile round-trip trek in order to get water on the other side. And this is continued with Brian Thomas at Baylor University and other places. They go to third world countries. One of the interesting things is that even in third world countries, you know, everybody has a cell phone, except they don't have ways to charge it. So he went down to Haiti, and he went around and found some good people, and he put up solar panels. And these solar panels were used to charge cell phones. And people would come around with their cell phones and pay a penny or 2 pennies in order to get their cell phone charged. And this was a big deal in a country where the average daily income is a dollar. And so he sets them up, and this is the way that appropriate technology works. He sets them up and then goes away and lets the nationals take over the company. This was also true in the Philippines. Walter helped start an organization there called Dignity Coconuts. You can go to Amazon and buy Dignity Coconut Oil, and this was an example of a business that he started in the Philippines. So appropriate technology is very, very, very cool, and is something that engineers should indeed do. How many saw the movie Unplanned? It was about, you remember that? Okay. Well, here's something interesting. Walter Bradley and his wife, Ann, were founders of either the first or one of the first crisis pregnancy centers in the United States. They did it in College Station, and Unplanned is about their crisis pregnancy center. That's where she went after she saw the horrors of an abortion. And so that's really interesting. So Walter is also in the crisis pregnancy business and was one of the first to start this. He started it out and he tried to get a number of churches on board, but a lot of the churches didn't really understand the problems with abortion, but he finally convinced them. And so initially most of the Crisis Pregnancy Center was funded by Walter and his wife. Really interesting. Let me go through some other things. This is pure Walter. There was an atheist club that was started at Baylor. Now, Baylor is supposedly a Christian university, so the atheist club was not condoned by Baylor University, but it kind of self-organized and met every week at the Student Union building. And I don't know about your reaction. My reaction was, we got to get in there and get these atheists off a Christian campus. They don't belong here, and we need to do whatever we can just to get rid of them. We don't want them poisoning the well. Well, Walter didn't do that. You know what he did? He went to their meeting, and he sat down with them, and he said, what are you talking about? Let's talk about this for a while. So he talked about it for a while. He went back the next week. They talked about it for a while. He invited them over to his house. They talked about it for a lot more time, and pretty soon the whole club dissolved. Now, looking at what Walter did, that was the right thing to do, wasn't it? It was the right thing to do. What I wanted to do was the wrong thing to do. And so I am always in awe of Walter Bradley. Another thing, I was at the church I was going to at the time, and I saw one of our graduate students walk by, and I said, Troy, what are you doing here? He said, well, I became a Christian. I said, really, what happened? He said, well, it was Walter Bradley. I said, well, what did he do? He says, well, we were talking, and Walter says, how's your soul? And it led to a conversation, and then Walter said, I tell you what, you know, we've talked about Christianity for a little bit. Let's you and I meet every week, and let's go through the Gospel of John. And they went through the Gospel of John for the next couple of months. And then at the end of the last lesson, Walter turned to Troy and said, you know what, Troy, you've been dating now this and flirting with this idea of Christianity. It's time to decide whether you're going to walk away or get married. And Troy decided, well, I think I'll get married. And so he became a Christian, and that's the reason I saw him at church. So I've learned a lot from Walter. So I did this myself, and I was talking to a student, and it came up to spiritual matters, and I said, well, I tell you what, let's meet for a couple of months. We'll go through the Gospel of John, and then you can decide whether Christianity is right for you or not. He said, okay. So we met in my office once a week, and at the end, I said the same thing that Walter said to his student. I said, you know, you've been flirting now and dating, and now it's time for you to decide whether you're going to get married or whether you're going to walk away. And he says, well, I don't know. I'm going to have to think about it. So I saw him about a month later, and it was in the parking lot. And he said, Dr. Marks. He came running out. He was so excited. He says, I've become a Christian. And I said, well, what happened? He says, I went back to China. He was concerned what his parents would think. That was his hesitation. So he went back to China, and he says, my mother just became a Christian, and we're working on my father right now. And I'm so excited that that, I became a Christian. Now, the interesting thing was this was a couple of months after we met, and he came out. I didn't remember his name. I mean, that was I was really embarrassed at that point. But since then, I've learned his name. He eventually went to work, and this is him. His name is Cheng Li Wei. He went to work for Mary Baylor Hardin University, which is down the street. It's a Christian university. You have to be a Christian to teach there. And so after he came to Christ, he applied there and has been working there. Walter witnesses in weakness. He contracted leukemia about 15 years ago. He survived it because of some miracle drugs, and God's hand blessed him. And people would come up to him and say, "Walter, man, I mean, what do you say with somebody with leukemia?" You might first avoid them, right? But they go up to him and they say, "Walter, man, you're dying of leukemia." And Walter would say, "Yeah, I'm going to die. You know what? You're going to die too. I just know a little bit closer to when I'm going to die than when you're going to die." And he led it into a segue about presentation of the gospel.
Wow.
So even in the weakness, even in the middle of leukemia, he was out there working for our God. We had a good friend, Elisa Tapiel, and she's the second to the last bullet. Says, "Walter Bradley and his wife Hand helped my husband Blake and me through the most beautiful and painful journey of our lives. My wife was good friends with Elisa, as was Walter and Ann. She lost a baby to SIDS." Now, if you're familiar with SIDS, all of a sudden you go in, you have a healthy baby, you walk in, they're dead. And this is just, you talk about post-traumatic stress syndrome, she had it. And my wife called her, and she didn't answer the phone. Walter called her, didn't answer the phone. So we said, "I don't know, what can we do?" Well, you know what Walter and Ann did? They went over to her house, and they said, "Come in." And they began to work with Elisa, and that's the reason that she said, "Walter Bradley and his wife helped my husband Blake and me through the most beautiful and most painful journey in our lives." The last thing I want to talk about Walter about is when my son broke his neck. My son was driving back from Seattle to Texas, rolled his vehicle over, broke his neck. It was the same vertebrae that Christopher Reeves, remember the guy that played Superman that broke his neck? He became a paraplegic, or no, quadriplegic. And luckily, the accident was witnessed by a nurse who said, "Don't move him, don't touch him. Because if you have a broken neck and you move the head improperly, it can sever the spine." So he was airlifted to a hospital. We finally got him home. He was constrained to have a halo attached to his head. Have you ever seen these halos? In fact, I have a picture of Joshua here after his accident. This is where they screw this thing into your skull so you can't move your neck. So during his recuperation period, he couldn't do anything. He couldn't ride in a car, because if he rode in a car, the bumps would aggravate his neck. So I tell you, I went home and I must have played 1,000 games of Scrabble with him, of cribbage, watching movies and all sorts of things. During the time, Walter was giving a class at Baylor on apologetics through a new book written by Norman Geisler. And I would take the lesson, and I would take it home every week, and I would go through this lesson of apologetics with my son. I mentioned this to Walter. Walter said, "Well, you know, this class is for faculty, but why don't you bring Joshua home?" Joshua to the class. And I said, "Walter, he can't drive in cars. He has a broken neck. He can't stand the jiggling." And Walter says, "Okay, no problem." So Walter came out to my house once a week for the rest of the course. I gave my son a one-on-one overview of the same topic that he covered in the apologetics class. There was no glory for him, there was no accolades, there was no visibility, and it really showed, I believe, the inner beauty that Walter Bradley had. Walter Bradley, last slide, is he was a thespian. This is him dressing up to play Doubting Thomas in a school play. Not in a church play, I should say. So we do have the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence that celebrates Walter Bradley and his legacy. I have written a book on it, along with William Dembski. It's called For a Greater Purpose. And if you're interested in this, it's available at all the different places you buy books. And it overviews the life of this incredible man who has taught so many people, including myself, to live out loud as a Christian. This is what I wrote in the introduction. Walter Bradley's life and career is unforgettable. His legacy has been established both inside and outside his day job as university professor. Don't forget, all of this time with ministry, he had a full-time job at the University of Texas, at Texas A&M, and then at Baylor University as a professor. He wrote proposals, he got in millions of dollars worth of grants, and he did everything that a professor's supposed to do. And as a Christian, we need to outperform everybody as much as we can. And Walter indeed did that during his day job. But during his off time, he did all of the things that I talked about here. The impact of his life, both professionally and as a lay ambassador for Christ, is widespread and enduring. Many Christians aspire to a heritage like this. But here's the bottom line. Ironically, such a goal of being like Walter Bradley cannot be achieved by making it a goal. I cannot say I want to be like Walter Bradley as a goal. It comes indirectly from dedicated hard work, bold decisions, and living a life selflessly motivated by a mission greater than self. And so if you adopt that, then you will become like Walter Bradley, not because you want to be like Walter Bradley, but that's the characteristics that he adopted to do the things that he did. So here is Walter and Anne. This was taken a few years ago. And again, the name of the book is For a Greater Purpose, if you want to read more about Walter Bradley. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you for listening.